Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this 1st of April. I'm just going to give you it straight from the very beginning. There will be no April Fool's jokes over the next 3 hours of this program. I find them exhausting. They never work for me, and I don't know what we can do to fool you. And quite frankly, with what we're all dealing with right now, do we need any more April Fool's jokes? I don't think so. So we're not going to. So at no time, if we say something, just assume we're accurate because we're not going to play that over the next 3 hours. We got enough to worry about. But I hope someone will get you later on in the day, you know. But it won't be us. Good morning, all. Welcome to this April Fool's broadcast. And let me introduce, far from fools this morning, we have a wonderful, wonderful group of individuals who are here to talk about the items in the news. We begin with Teresa Bourgeois, public policy and communications expert. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Oh, actually, we'll get you on mic 5. That's my fault.
Okay.
Mic 5.
Sorry,
there you
sir.
Go. Yep.
I'm doing very well. I had an interesting experience the last few days where I had a whole bunch of trees cut from my property. It is what it is. But the guy is going to mill the trees. I'm restoring my house, so he's going to mill them so I can use the wood from the trees cut in my yard to help restore the exterior of my house.
That's very cool.
Isn't that fun?
That's very neat.
It's a house that's been in the family since 1913, so.
Wow.
That my grandfather and my mother planted.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Isn't that fun?
Well, that's really nice. That's neat.
I don't know why I'm sharing it, but I just can't get over how fun it is.
Because we all need good things in our lives to talk about, and that's a really good thing.
That's
a very cool thing.
I said, let me do that for you. I know how to do that.
And will the I think you answered this, but I just want to double check. But the wood will be on the outside of the house?
It'll definitely be on the outside of the house, some slats and some decorative trim and such. And it's possible, because it was an oak tree, that there might be some oak floors in my future.
See, that's just beautiful to communicate with the nature of the outdoors of your home. I think that's beautiful.
Indeed, and not just cut them down and have them disappear, but to have them have a purpose.
Good for you.
Isn't that? Well good for the guy who's going to do it.
Think of all of that. We welcome Alexander Mihailovich to the program, professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of A Liberal Vanguard Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here again.
Really nice to have you here. We always love having you. We got a lot to talk about with you and all of our panelists, and we thank you very much for being here. Mike Spain joins us, former Times Union associate editor, a dear friend of this program. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here.
Excellent. I thought you were going to talk longer, and I was going to take a sip of tea, but no. It's okay.
How happy are you?
I'm very happy. Actually, the funny thing is, I just got back from Portland, Oregon, where visiting my daughter and her family, and they have a giant tree in front of their house. And they are looking at the exact same scenario. And there is an arborist or a tree cutter that will take the tree down and convert, you know, and mill the wood, and then they would use it to do some things around the house. It seems like a very Oregonian thing, what's going on in Cohoes for you.
Yeah. I've been looking for somebody to do it, and I finally thought, I got to get the trees down.
Yeah.
And so the guy that I hired to do it, I was saying, you know, I wished I could find somebody. He said, well, I'll do that.
Oh, isn't that great?
Isn't that fantastic? Yeah. He thinks it's kind of fun. I'm thrilled by it. Yeah.
That's really cool. Wonderful, wonderful story. All right. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome. Don't forget, you can join in. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Just a quick event announcement that I would like to make, that I think it was last month we were scheduled to have a conversation with MSNBC's Chris Hayes about his book, and that was canceled due to inclement weather. And now the event is going to take place on Saturday, this Saturday, April 5th at 7 o'clock. It was originally at, I believe, UPAC. It's now at Bardavon. So if you have the original tickets, it's at Bardavon now in Poughkeepsie. So we went from Kingston to Poughkeepsie, but it's still at 7 p.m., and it is should be a really great evening, and you can find out more by going to oblongbooks.com. Oblongbooks.com. They're sponsoring the event, and find out more information. But it will be a really good time and a lot of fun.
Fantastic.
So, it's Chris Hayes, the Sirens Call Tour, in conversation with me at Bardavon with Oblong Books, Saturday, April 5th, 7 o'clock. Okay. Now, let's get to the news of the day and what is going on, and we will talk about all that stuff. And there's a lot.
So much.
There's a lot. So we begin with the... I thought we'd just do a general story. There was a piece in the Times yesterday about the Trump momentum test, talking about this as a crucial week for Trump. Whenever I read articles like this, I always think you hear the television and radio announcers when there's a State of the Union address or a convention speech, and they say, "This is the most important speech of their political life."
Breaking news.
Yes, that's right. So when I see crucial week for Trump, I mean, they're all pretty crucial, right? I mean, I think that's the nature of the job. But they're looking at all of these things that have come together. I think it's generally presumed and thought that last week, maybe not a great week for the president and his agenda, but... So now, this crucial week for Trump, new tariffs and elections will test his momentum. So a lot coming together in the next few days. Down ballot races in Florida and Wisconsin are seen as a referendum on the White House, while the president's to-be-announced reciprocal tariff plan is increasingly worrying investors and consumers. Because the stock market had a great day yesterday, not. President Trump's political momentum will face a major test this week as Democrats try to turn various down-ballot races into a referendum on the White House, and Mr. Trump's long-promised tariffs risk rattling allies and consumers alike. A state Supreme Court election in Wisconsin today is seen as an indicator of support for Mr. Trump, particularly after Elon Musk and groups he funds spend more than $20 million to bolster Mr. Trump's preferred candidate. White House officials have also been increasingly concerned with the unusually competitive race on Tuesday for a deep red House seat in Florida, left vacant after Representative Michael Waltz stepped down to serve as Trump's national security advisor. The White House is hoping victories in those races will tighten Mr. Trump's grip on the Republican Party as his team seeks to overcome the backlash from his inadvertent sharing of military plans on a commercial app with a journalist. The Florida election is critical for Republicans who hold a narrow majority in the House as they try to pass the president's agenda. I mean, one thing to point out of that race is that if both these candidates win, we'll just be where we are now, right? So there will be no additional. Am I right on that?
Well, if both of the Republicans win, yes. Yeah.
Correct. And that's expected. I mean, you're taking Waltz and Gates and replacing them with two other Republicans.
Right. Yes. But understand that currently today, not tomorrow when they're sworn in after they're elected, be it theoretically, if they do win today, they don't have those two votes. So they will actually bolster the Republican majority in the House somewhat. And there are a couple other vacancies because of deaths, I believe.
Yes.
It's not a full house, using a playing card metaphor.
Yes. We're an 80s sitcom. Yes.
True.
not a full house. So the election there, of course, considered to be critical. And then there is the judicial contest in Wisconsin that Trump is calling a big race, and he was signing executive orders in the Oval Office yesterday and said Wisconsin is a big state politically and the Supreme Court has a lot to do with elections in Wisconsin. And as I mentioned earlier, Elon Musk has spent a lot of time in that state and trying to have a impact on that race. Teresa.
Well, $20 million spent on a judge's race, I think, should raise a lot of concerns. I don't know if it's unprecedented, but I would guess it's close to unprecedented. And they're saying the quiet part out loud about why that race is so important to them, because there is redistricting on the horizon in Wisconsin, and the judge could rule on the redistricting, and so they seem to want to control that judgeship. But that's not how judgeships are supposed to work, right? In a democracy. And they're not even, the Republicans, Musk, those folks aren't even pretending to be coy about why they want that seat and that judgeship. So that's disturbing for democracy. And also the question of whether or not there might be some cases having to do with Musk's holdings that in some way might come before that judge. But I do think while it's unlikely that the Democrats will win either of those House seats, it will be interesting to see what the margins are. And this gets down into the weeds a bit. But those are seats that I believe both won by 20, 30 points. And so right now, one of them is within the margin of error. And if even if the Republican wins, but it's in the margin of error, that speaks quite a bit to what's going on. And in general, I do think it's a big week because the economy. Remember that Trump and his ilk and these Republicans, they ran on a pledge to strengthen people's personal economy, and that's not going so well for them.
No, it isn't. I think the other aspect of this is that this is a familiar scenario or talking point or script, let me put it this way, of the Republicans, at least since Reagan. When Trump was running during his campaign and Musk was boostering his position as, you know, somebody who was going to come in and advise Trump about fiscal matters and budgetary issues, Musk openly said there will be pain, right? And this is something that not during the election. I thought was it afterwards?
After the election.
Afterwards. Okay. All right.
Because Doge wasn't announced until after the election.
During the election, on the first day, we're going to get those egg prices down on the first day. It's all going to be happy, happy, happy.
Yeah. But let me just quote something that Reagan said in 1982. In regard to sort of budget cuts and sort of scaling down the government, he said, we're here to cut back on waste and mismanagement to eliminate unnecessary restrictive regulations and make it harder for the American economy to compete and harder for American workers to find jobs, to drain the swamp of overtaxation, overregulation, and runaway inflation that has dangerously eroded our free way of life. It won't be easy. There will be pain. All right. So it's interesting to see how this way of viewing governmental fiscal decisions is something that is really not new. People are talking very often about the ways in which Trump has broken with the conservative Republican playbook, but in many ways he's simply continuing it, as is Musk, it seems to me. And Musk is quite, as you put it, Teresa, he's quite open about some of his interests in the Wisconsin judicial race. He has openly admitted that he is very, you know, peeved and annoyed that Wisconsin won't allow him to establish dealerships for Tesla there.
Right.
He's made no secret of this. So I think
this issue is his own personal economy.
Yes. Yes.
As is going after the FAA and driving out the FAA administrator because the inspector generals there were investigating Starlink, you know, and
and then there's
I'm sorry, US. Excuse me, I'm wrong about that. USAID was investigating Starlink. The FAA was the pollution issues. I apologize.
One minute, Mike.
Oh, yeah. But to add to that, I mean, the idea that government is bloated and government is overstaffed and it's costing taxpayers needlessly, it's not strictly a Republican thing. You know, Al Gore headed the Commission to Redo Government back in the Clinton administration in the 90s. But there's a difference, and I think, Alex, you pointed it out. It's demonizing people who work for the government and demonizing government agencies and suggesting that they're only standing in the way of your personal freedom and prosperity and ability to do business and ability to get a job. That seems to be a Republican narrative. Democrats, I think, have traditionally supported the value of government, but they, you know, recognize a possibility of getting rid of waste and consolidation and using technology, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the two, you know, sort of want to achieve the same thing, and they want to be accountable. But the demonizing of federal workers, the demonizing of anything that an agency does is, I think, more prevalent among Republican politicians.
When we come back from break, we'll talk about the second part of this story, which is Liberation Day, which is coming up this week. And that expected tomorrow. And we'll learn more about tariffs. And we'll talk about that when we return. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alexander Mihailovich, Mike Spain, and Teresa Bourgeois with us. Again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this quick news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we're talking about this crucial week for Donald Trump in the sense of the elections which are happening today and how those will turn out. The other event, the other plan that is going forward is the reciprocal tariff plan, which is expected to be revealed tomorrow. The president has labeled it Liberation Day, saying the nation will finally break free of past trade relationships that he argues have cheated the United States. Investors, however, are growing more concerned that the tariffs could fuel inflation and slow consumer spending, potentially driving up economic anxieties among voters. Looking to see where the Dow is at this moment, a bond opening, but
it was opening down.
The
futures were all down. I don't know.
Down 229. Okay.
Yeah, futures were down.
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt brushed off those concerns on Monday. The president will be announcing a tariff plan that will roll back the unfair trade practices that have been ripping off our country for decades. He's doing this in the best interest of the American worker. The president has always said that the stock market is a snapshot for a moment in time, and he's doing what's best for Main Street, and Wall Street will work out just fine. So quit your belly aching. Teresa?
It may work out fine for somebody, but not the average worker. And not somebody who wants to buy a car, not somebody who was listening to the, you know this, Joe, the crafts beer makers, is that what they call them? Crafts beer.
Yeah.
That they get a bunch of their product from Germany, which is going to be very difficult, and aluminum cans are going to be very, so they have to figure out a different way. So they're all different sectors of the but I think people should take a look at the farmers. Like, what is the impact going to be on farmers? Because it's going to be very significant. And the last time Trump did this, it was so
it was the grain deal to China. I mean, basically not selling grain to China to punish China, but it punished the farmers. You mean that in the first Trump
Well, hog prices fell, soybeans fell. But they needed to, it was so devastating to farmers, they needed to do a package to support them. And so there was $23 billion in supports that were needed to allow the farmers to sustain themselves through these Trump tariffs in the last iteration. But this iteration, there's a question about what, even though the Secretary of Agriculture is proposing in advance that there be some sort of protections, not protections, but some sort of supports for them. But this is happening in conjunction with the decimation of USAID, which is huge amounts of loss to the farmers. It's decimating the funding for the school lunch programs, for the backpack programs, for all of those which get their food, the supports from the farmers. So at this time, not only are they taking a hit from the tariffs, but they're also taking a hit from a significant amount of other programs that have been slashed by the Trump, Musk, and Vance administration. So this is going to be very deeply troubling to the farmers, as just an example, all across the board. And what business people need, they say over and over again, is certainty. They, you know, whatever you're going to do, we just need some certainty so we can plan. There is no certainty here. This is uncertainty. And you see it in the markets. You saw the bad economic numbers come out last Friday, which is, I think, why Trump started talking about whether or not he'd run for a third term. I think he wanted to deflect from the really bad economic news you saw on Friday. You see that markets continue to tumble yesterday and today. Mm. So I think that this is tariffs are a tax, no matter what he and his ilk say. And the American people, this is going to be costly to small businesses. It's going to be costly to restaurants. It's going to be costly to farmers. It's going to be costly to across the board.
Mm. Well, don't you think by tomorrow there'll be some trade-offs? You know, he'll cut little side deals with some countries over some products, and or at least in the next week or so. I mean, that's the sort of Trumpian thing. You know, it's to be draconian and then back off it a little bit and look like you're you're conciliatory. I mean, I think he's calling for these tariffs, and I think Europe and others are calling his bluff, and they're going to impose tariffs themselves. But it just seems like there's some back channel efforts to mitigate this some way. So I don't think it's going to be good, but I think that's
the recurring line, and I call this more Trump sane washing. Yeah. The recurring line is, well, this is just Trump the great negotiator. This is just Trump the great negotiator.
Well, that's their portrayal of it.
Right? You know? Yeah. And this is how he does business, because he's a great business person. But what's happening? What's happening around the world? What's happening in Canada is, we're not going to be bullied like this. We are going to build partnerships with Europe. We're going to build partnerships with South America. So they're taking their business and they're looking for their business elsewhere now. So all around the world, people are doing the same thing. And I read, I'm not an expert by any means in tariffs, but I read that in the last iteration of these Trump tariffs, a lot of companies lost market share that they have never regained, because people can't trust the market, the accessibility to market share. And so if this happens again now, in conjunction with the broader bullying that Trump is doing to Mexico, to Canada, to other places, what even if he cuts some deals, and what's the payback for the deals, right? That's not how you should run business, special deals for special friends. But what's the long-term impact if we lose these markets?
I mean, can it be that he simply doesn't care if we lose those markets? I think we need to bear that in mind. I mean, among other things, if there is a strategic aspect to all of this from the point of view of appealing to the American voter or the American voter who voted for Trump, he's banking on the fact that this is the first time that anybody has lived through a trade war. The last time this significantly happened in American history was the last 20 decades of the 19th century, on a scale that is happening now. And so that's one aspect of it. Another aspect is that what strikes me is kind of the utopian character of his economic planning. He's assuming somehow that we're going to enter into a golden age of American business as a result, of this kind of, you know, new robust American global power in a multipolar world. And there's no evidence that this will happen, at least under current economic markers. The idea that American manufacturing will experience a robust comeback, that's something that's very iffy, given the fact that you need a whole kind of
raw materials.
Well, raw materials, but also a kind of you need to build, extensive brick and mortar facilities.
A manufacturing infrastructure that Biden was laying the groundwork for, in which he has Trump in the first 30, 40 days eliminate a lot of the funding for that groundwork that the Biden administration or Raven Langer.
Also, the Obama administration, manufacturing under Obama, American manufacturing was up. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it was still the nature of manufacturing globally is for the most part, it doesn't have the same prominence in the global economic picture as it once did. But there's no evidence that Trump is doing anything to sort of bring that to some kind of practical fruition. And the other aspect of this is the last thing I'll say about this is that, Trump openly said the other day that I don't care if prices get higher.
Right. But again, I'm not an expert, but it seems to me, and sounds like you'd know better, that he seems to be willing it with words, not with actions, in terms of willing the manufacturing. So yes, we need to bring back our manufacturing base, and we certainly learned it during the pandemic that for our own personal security, chips, right? So, but there's been a plan. I mean, Schumer's been on a 10-year plan to bring chips back to bring chips here, right? But Trump is trying to wipe out what was done and start again under his name or something. But you use the word utopian, and I agree with that because it seems like even just understanding how cars are made, right? It's a long ago view of how cars are made because now cars are made between the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, right? But he has in his mind that they're all made in this country, but that's not how they're made anymore.
And another part of this is if U.S. manufacturing were to surge, like he is professing it will, it won't succeed if we are the only consumers. Americans are the only consumers. They'll need to sell those products across the globe. And with tariffs and reciprocal tariffs and a trade war, that's going to be very difficult also. We'll be victimized by other countries imposing, retaliatory tariffs on us. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And yet it's a very popular notion. Bring back those jobs. Bring back, the bread and butter days when American workers came home with money in their pocket and spent it wildly and all that. And it's just the world has changed.
Well, I mean, Trump in many ways is somebody who's living in the 70s and the
80s.
And I think that he's really thinking of American car manufacturing before the 1970s oil embargo.
Right.
All of the components for making a car were essentially within U.S. Facilities. Now you have parts for cars that are manufactured in Canada, parts of those cars, those same American cars that are manufactured in Mexico, for example. And every time those parts go over the border, there is a tariff. And so this is actually going to hit American car makers. Now, I understand that, one can say, well, then we need to rethink the whole picture and have some of these components, more of them or a larger proportion of them manufactured in the U.S. Okay, fine. But how do you actually make this happen? It requires, Teresa, as you said, a whole kind of physical presence of, the production supply chain within the United States for that to be a realistic picture. Again, this all strikes me as deeply utopian, and another way to put it is profoundly impractical.
We have many letters. We'll get to those when we come back. Teresa Bourgeois, Alexander Mihailovich, and Mike Spain will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We have a lot to talk about, so we will continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to John. Teresa is 100% correct. Canada and the rest of the world are fed up and are beginning to root around the U.S. Route around, route around. R-O-U-T-E.
Get around.
Get around. Yes.
Go in
you.
A different direction.
That's right.
John's
Since
right.
World War II, the entire global economy runs through the U.S. Trump is causing the rest of the world to go around the U.S. 40 years ago, at age 16, I made this analogy. The U.S. is like a building with large cables connecting it to surrounding buildings, so many that it's now being held up by those cables. When the neighboring buildings cut those cables, the instability of our internal support will become apparent. Trump is driving our allies to cut those support cables, and the U.S. is going to collapse on itself, just as Putin wants. That from John. Rob writes, I'm a customs and trade attorney. I've been doing this for 20 years. The administration can spin it any way they want, but the president does not have the power to unilaterally raise tariffs long term. He has some ability to increase in the short term, but it's Congress that is empowered to make these decisions long term. Despite the administration's noise, tariffs are taxes.
Thank you. Thank you. Yep. They are taxes. No matter how many times this administration and Trump says they're not, they are taxes. And you, the consumer, will be paying those taxes.
But the another part of that last letter, too, is that Congress should step in and exercise its constitutional role. Well, it has demonstrated so far that it has no intention of exercising that role and being a equal branch of government and exercising its checks and balances. It has sat on its hands, and that's why things are not, you know, and it's all shifting now. All the fights are in the courts, not on the congressional level.
But great letter, because it really points out you know how the process is supposed to work if we're following, you know, back in the day when we followed our Constitution.
All right, we go to Linda, who writes to us and says, the markets did not tumble yesterday. The S&P and Dow were up. The NASDAQ was done, but not big.
Sorry.
Please be careful with your facts. Well, I think what we were referring to, at least what I was referring to, is that the reports came out about the first quarter yesterday and the end of the first quarter. And stocks ended the first quarter of 2025 near their lows of the year. And I believe since 2022.
Yeah, lows over, yeah, since the pandemic.
Yes.
Since pandemic lows over the course of the quarter.
And the tariffs have been a major driver, with the S&P 500 falling 5.7% in March alone. So that's what we were referring
to. But yesterday alone, it picked up a ton. That's what it's been doing. It's been going down, you know.
It drops early in the morning.
Drops, and then it picks up a little bit, and then it drops, and it picks up a little more. But it's still on a downward cascade.
And that I was
yesterday by itself, it was up a little bit.
Apologies, I was more thinking of the stories that I was reading about the overall first quarter, how far it's down to pandemic level.
So you're both right.
No, she's right. I was wrong.
No, she. I.
She was a good point.
It's we're clarifying. That's all.
Yeah. Sorry.
Jack says there is no economic rationale for Trump's tariffs. He is solely attempting to create conditions of deprivation and high prices that existed in 1930s Germany. These conditions will enable him to amass more power and install a fascist power structure where only those companies and businesses and people that grovel for Trump will be supported / live. The sooner everyone realizes this, the sooner solutions and defenses can be discussed and pursued. Mm. Anything you want to say on that?
I completely agree. It's a very sensible observation.
Yeah, but it's grim as hell.
It's grim, but let me put it this way. Yeah. I think it's important to remind the American voter about the blatant fantasy element of so much of the current policy, you know, coming from the White House, and you know that this is not resulting in the tangible benefits that the Trump administration claims that it will have or is having.
But is it that they are just profoundly wrong in their estimations, and they actually believe what they're doing will, you know, ultimately improve the lot for people? Or are they so insidious that they're planning a recession like Germany had in the 1930s and 20s and 30s after World War I? are they planning that so that they can orchestrate some fascist takeover? I don't know which one is which, but the results may be exactly the same.
Well, I lean in the direction of saying that they're true believers in this.
Right. So you they know? Believe it. Yeah. They're just wrong.
Yeah, they're wrong. Well, that's a separate a separate issue, of course. But yes, they firmly believe it, and you know, and I mean, look, I think so much of Trump's thinking about Ukraine, for example, and the supposed economic renaissance of diplomatic and business relations between the Russian Federation and the U.S. So much of that has to do with what I would call the mirage of money. And it's this idea that somehow there's going to be this big payoff from a radical new way of doing things. And yes, it's risky, but it will happen. It will happen. I think they firmly believe this. Mm. And just also judging from, I make this assessment also on the basis of Trump's impressionistic, kind of impulsive statements. He's very suggestible. Just to give you an example, in Riyadh in February, when there was the first round of negotiations about peace in Ukraine that excluded Ukraine, that had representatives of the Russian Federation and the U.S., Kirill Dmitriev, who is essentially kind of the economic advisor of Sergei Lavrov, submitted to the Trump people an assessment of how much money the U.S. would have made from economic cooperation with Russia had it not put the sanctions in place.
Right.
And Dmitriev came up with this figure of $350 billion. That figure then turns up later in one of Trump's statements when he said to Zelensky, not in the Oval Office, but prior to that, you owe us $350 billion. He gets that figure from Dmitriev's report, which actually had nothing specifically to do with Ukraine. It was only about the sanctions, which, of course, were in response to the invasion. But he kind of recycles that figure, in that statistic, in a completely different context. And he's simply not thinking this through.
No basis in fact. And he keeps getting corrected, yet he continues to repeat it.
Yeah. So,
but don't you think the other thing, Kudlow and others were on yesterday, it clearly was the talking points. Trust Trump. He had these tariffs the last go round, and it worked out for everybody. He cares about the working person, trust Trump. But one of the things that's different this time is that it's not only the tariffs, the same thing I'm saying with the farmers, it's not only the tariffs, but it's happening at the same time as you have the decimate cuts in research funding. Mm-hmm. You have the impending Medicaid cuts. You're probably going to get some Medicare cuts. So there are all of these economic assaults, I would say, or impacts that are all going to happen at pretty much around the same time. And so in and of themselves, dubious that they'll work, clear that they are a tax and clear that the consumer will be paying for it. But on top of that, these range of other economic disturbances, shall we call earthquakes, some would say, that are going to compound the problem for working families.
We just have a moment. I want to get to the remaining letters that we have in this break. Rick says, I guess it's safe to assume that you are all tiptoeing around this issue of Musk and Trump dumping millions and having a lottery to win these elections. I'm sure you have a lot more stake than I do. However, the bottom line is we have to eliminate Citizens United. Just the fact that Elon Musk is personally offering $1 million in a lottery to voters should be illegal. What say you? Well, we've talked about this extensively
right.
on the program.
I thought Citizens United was ended anonymous giving.
And also Elon, as a corporation, as a human. Yes.
Yeah. But right, and he is an individual, has a lot of money. I think even if Citizens United, I could be wrong, had stayed in place, an individual can spend as much money as he likes if he doesn't hide who he is.
We will also say this. Went to court three times.
Yeah.
Both during the general election and now, and has failed to move forward. Not that that...
I don't understand how it's not paying for votes. I don't get the legal. I'm not a lawyer. I'm confused about how that's not paying for votes, but I'm not a lawyer.
It's not directly paying, but it gets nuanced because you sign a petition that says, I am against activist judges, and you get $100. Well, those people are already likely to vote that way, and they're motivated that way. They're motivated by money, but is it buying votes? I don't know.
John says, I think you have to stop talking about Trump as though there's any chance that he's really trying to help America, especially America's long-term future. Is that really the vibe we're given?
I'll say this. We're sort of discussing this last time around whether Trump is just completely inept and making grotesque mistakes in trying to help the country, or is he intending to collapse the economy so he can affect what one of the writers said was the fascist takeover of the country?
But I think it gets back to the lawyers. Very good point, which is that this is the Congress needs to make this decision. And so this gets back to the same question. Will the Congress do its job? Will the Republicans in the House and Senate do their job and vote on these things, vote up, vote down, vote on them? Because that's the democracy. That's what our Constitution says.
Yeah, but if you don't fulfill your role, the democracy doesn't work.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. More spirited chat after this break and news with Rick Raff. If you've ever listened to the show and at some point you say, oh my God, will they ever shut up? Cory Booker's been going for 15 hours.
Yay. Yay, Cory Booker. It's been...
Man, holding a marathon speech on the Senate for 15 hours, 8 minutes, 4 seconds. So,
Good Lord.
He continues to go. Can you imagine?
I can imagine because I was watching it during the night. Who would do that? I was fixated. He's reading letters from people.
Pretty late for a school night.
I know. But I was also trying to do my prep work. But, you know, it's what people have been asking for. He's reading letter after letter after constituent letter. He's been talking about issues in groups. He did an hour or so on the cuts to the research. Across the board, university research and the devastating impacts of that and what the kinds of benefits you get from investment in research. He did a whole segment on the cuts in Medicaid and the cascading impacts of the cuts in Medicaid. It's for the patient, but also for the hospital. And often these are rural hospitals, so the local economy depends on that and the cascading impacts of that. And throughout the night, Senator Chris Murphy, and then earlier in the morning, Senator Gillibrand, they did a whole back and forth with her for quite a long time on the national security cuts, some of the pullback in guards against Russia.
Yeah.
It's been very, very, I have found it interesting. Some great dialogue, and it's really what people have been asking for.
Some people have asked for that, and I think it's really important and essential for it to happen. It's contrast to the soundbite approach that the Trump administration takes. Everything is like, you know, a sentence or a soundbite or even a chant. You know, if you can reduce it to that, it's a lot easier to get the message across, even if it's the wrong message. So it's... For the record, it's really important, and I think what he's doing, and the fact that it's 15 hours, just alone, just that fact, is demonstrating the commitment that some people have to, you know, the facts, the truth, the you know, and the full debate of things, and we need more full debate of things. And I think he's part of the future of the party. I really do. You know, who's going to emerge as the future of the Democratic Party? And I think Cory Booker will be
among
right
those.
There.
Yeah.
And he does have a soundbite, which is, this is not normal. What's happening right now is not normal. We're not following the regular processes. We're not, and it's not normal. And the people are scared. And he reads letter after letter after letter. Social Security recipients are scared. USAID are scared for what our country is not standing for, doing, or helping with. farmers are scared, you know, and but his soundbite is, listen, folks, this is not normal. Wake up. This is a problem. Our country has a problem right now, and it's an economic problem. It's a democracy problem. It's mm-hmm. who we are as a country and how we interact with each other and our neighbors and our allies.
All right. We're going to move on to other subjects. I want to get as much information out of Alexander as we can while he's here and exploit his expertise on this issue of Russia. So I would like to talk about two things. One is that the two, I think, latest things that we haven't really talked about yet on the show is that Putin keeps pushing with Trump and on the battlefield. The Russian leaders' drones are deluging Ukrainian cities while his negotiating tactics test the patience of the friendliest White House he has faced in decades. But even Donald Trump is saying that he is getting irked. I don't believe that was the exact term he used, but it was the one that I came up with. And then the other, and we can go into this later about sort of what ultimately what Trump's Arctic can offer President Trump specifically. But let's go where we are right now, Alexander, about Putin and the pushing that he's doing, which is from the playbook, right?
It's from the playbook, but under a new rubric, I would say, which is about energy policy. Let me point out that this most recent ceasefire that was supposedly negotiated, by the Trump administration between Ukraine and the Russian Federation, which the Russian Federation broke, of course. The idea behind it was based on the notion that energy resources and infrastructure should not be damaged. And this was actually an idea, a proposal that was advanced by the Russian Federation to Trump in response to Ukrainian drone attacks on oil refineries outside of Moscow. The Russian Federation wanted that to stop. So they use this as a loophole, essentially, for saying, we won't attack their energy resources and infrastructure. They won't attack ours. But that leaves, of course, a wide area of places that could get bombarded, which is indeed what happened. The Russian Federation, however, quickly broke this even in regard to energy infrastructure specifically. And so this is yet another broken agreement. Trump seems to be responding with anger to this broken promise that at the very least, the Russian Federation would hold in a legalistic sense to this aspect of the agreement that they wouldn't attack these sites of energy resourcing and production. So that's what seems to be making him very angry, because, of course, resources, energy resources and mineral resources is the only thing that interests him in regard to both the Russian Federation and Ukraine. Now, I don't know if any of you saw the very peculiar, as a kind of a charitable word for it, interview that Tucker Carlson conducted with Steve Witkoff on March 21st. Witkoff began to ramble in between statements about how Putin was very concerned about Trump, the multiple assassination attempts on him, and lit a candle for him in his parish Orthodox Church, praying for Trump. But amidst all of that, there was a comment that Witkoff made about, wouldn't it be a wonderful world if the U.S. and Russia could cooperate in energy production and distribution, especially in regard to liquefied natural gas? Imagine if we had free access to all of those routes around Siberia, Scandinavia, and Greenland. We could transport this liquefied natural gas to different parts of the world that will sorely need it. So now the picture is emerging with a little bit more explicit character. We're seeing that this indeed is something, a talking point, that both the U.S., the Putin administration, and the Trump administration are advocating for, really agitating for. Why? People have often said recently that the Trump administration has virtually no leverage on the Putin administration. This is not completely true, because one of the things that the Putin administration is very interested in is American technology about oil and gas extraction in permafrost conditions. There are apparently all sorts of oil and gas fields in Siberia and in the Barents Sea that Russia has been trying to extract. They have a very large fleet of icebreakers, mm-hmm. Which actually is significantly larger than that of the U.S. But what they don't have specifically is the extraction, full access to the extraction technology over which American companies have essentially a kind of a trademark. And so they're very interested in some kind of partnership where American companies will come in and assist with that energy resourcing. Now, this is something that is not new. This was already in full force during the 90s and in the 2000s, but also as far back as the 1930s. Fred Chase Koch, the father of the Koch brothers, in the late 1920s and early 1930s, he, with his Wichita, Kansas refinery company, he managed to set up 15 different oil refineries within the Soviet Union. And in 1932, one of the worst years of the Depression, he made off with $500,000, which doesn't seem like very much now, but at that time, that was very significant. So what I'm saying, in other words, I'm just to sort of wrap this up, is that this has been really a kind of a running theme in Russian-American relations for our entire lifetimes. And it's now become, you know, again, ascendant, it seems to me.
So Russia needs the technology that the U.S. has. Has the U.S. been denying Russia that because of the Ukraine war? Is that part of the sanctions that have been put on Russia?
Yes, yes. And another aspect of this is, of course, that a big part of the sanctions is the exclusion of most Russian financial institutions from the SWIFT transaction system, the banking system. And if you listen to the Russian language news, as I have recently, this is something that the Russians are very interested in obtaining access to again. All of the major banks, the eight major banks, but especially Sberbank, which is the oldest continuously running bank in the Russian Federation. It has, you know, a kind of a Soviet precursor institution. Sberbank cannot conduct SWIFT economic transactions, and the largest single shareholder of Sberbank is the Russian state. So in other words, the Russian state itself is getting a hit economically as a result of the sanctions, and they are very interested in those being lifted. And they're using this kind of energy deal as a sort of a point of access to obtaining that, it seems to me.
Can I ask three things? So many questions. Is there a similar goal for the area that the Russians have taken from the Ukrainians to get the rare earths? Isn't that also, they seem to be trying to work out some sort of partnership on to jointly exploit those rare earths in the property that Russia now holds?
Yes. I'm sorry. Do you want to finish that question?
And then I also wondered about some of the sanctions have been lifted, and a whole variety of changes Trump has made in the last couple of months in terms of easing the pressures that were on Russia. These tariff changes, are they in any way beneficial to Russia and the partnership?
No. Those have no particular relation to Russia at all. I mean, I think that there is a sense in which, you know, the tariffs, are disadvantageous for the European Union notionally, you know, people within the foreign ministry of the Russian Federation like that, but it has no particular economic impact.
Because he said he was threatening to add tariffs, but I thought, well, what tariffs is going to impose? Because there are all these sanctions that were already supposed to be on them. So what more tariffs could he impose that would be a problem for them?
He wants to sort of, you know, he's seriously...
Trump
is seriously considering lifting those sanctions against the Russian Federation in order to create a kind of series of new economic relations between the Russian Federation and the U.S. And as far as Ukraine is concerned, now one of the things that strikes me about, you know, the Trump administration's pronouncements about the war in Ukraine and, you know, their idea of how to end it is that they're being deliberately obscure very often. The sense... A lot of the information is coming out in dribs and drabs. And one of the things that's coming out very gradually is that the Trump administration seems to have an understanding of any kind of resource sharing in Ukraine that would be the same for on the Ukrainian side and on the Russian side. They see this as some kind of a symmetry, right? Trump has made statements where he seems to, you know, point to the fact of, well, you know, we're going to have this economic, you know, this mineral deal with Ukraine, and there's going to be something similar to that on the Russian side in terms of the areas that have already been seized, formally annexed by the Russian Federation.
But wouldn't that be obscene for the U.S. to exploit in partnership with Russia?
No leading the witness.
I'm sorry. All right. That sounds comical.
Yeah, but let me
point. What difference is okay.
No, I mean, I just like.
Yeah, it is.
Seriously.
Okay. But let me point out, Teresa, that already this is the assumption within the Trump administration. It seems to me very clearly that those five territories that Russia has annexed from Ukraine, they're just gone. All gone. Even Tucker Carlson and Steve Witkoff, they made this sort of mind-bogglingly, you know, historically inaccurate statement that Khrushchev gave all five of those regions, he gifted them to Ukraine. This is not true. He only gifted Crimea. Those four other regions have always been a part of Ukraine within living memory. And the assumption is that it's a part of Russia, and we are going to come up with some kind of agreement about how to manage those resources.
Well, it's appalling to say that they're gone, but to not only say that they're gone, but say that, well, we're going to go partner with Russia to exploit those materials. But the other thing that I thought was troubling is that this new marker, it seems new to me, you can correct me, that Putin laid down last week where he was saying that the Ukrainian government, a different government needed to be installed.
Yeah,
and he talks about under the auspices of the United Nations Zelensky had to go. Now, that seems to me to be a new marker.
It's a new marker, but I think it's largely rhetorical, given the fact that, you know, how can I put it?
But he's moving the ball.
He's moving the ball. He's broaching.
The line.
He's broaching the idea. He's putting it out there. But I think it's not going to realistically happen, just because of the disinclination of so many countries within the UN.
But then it's another reason not to have an agreement. And remember that Trump said, "I will have a deal on day one. In fact, I will end this war even before I get sworn in." Right?
Yeah,
what he said? Just like the egg prices were going to go down, which they haven't, and so on and so forth.
I'm shocked that Trump has made some assertions that he has not followed through successfully on.
Yes.
All due respect, what's happening here, and I'm really, Alex, I'm curious what you think may be the outcome of this. If Trump truly is inflamed and angry, like he said he was to Kristen Welker in that interview Sunday, and getting very angry at Putin for the way that Putin's acting, I mean, what does that mean for achieving peace? If he just because so much of his personal, so much of what he does is personal. We're in a retribution presidency now. He's going after law firms that supported Democrats. He's going after Congress, Congress members that have spoken out against him. He's now he even toyed with the idea of saying that January that the Biden pardons on the January 6th committee are not valid. You know, I mean, he's really all about retribution. What will happen if he just sort of like becomes angry? You know, I mean, you know, very angry at Putin as opposed to wanting to chum up to him.
Well, my assessment of this is that the statement of anger, the assertion of it, is performative.
Right. Mm. Oh, absolutely.
You know, I think that he's not completely serious about it. Trump is, you know, sees himself as an alpha male on the global stage. He does not want to be punked. He doesn't want to be humiliated. So these kind of verbal outbursts are his way of what he thinks is negotiation.
And doesn't it look like he's been played and he's trying to...
Yeah, and the central premises about Ukraine, his central premises and Rubio's have not changed, it seems to me, and Witkoff's certainly. They want to give essentially the Russian Federation what it wants, right, which is institutional control, political control of Ukraine, and formal acknowledgement of the annexed territories, territories.
And within the U.S., they've cut back on a lot of the oversights that we had, right? That they've cut back on the group of people in the State Department that watched over election interference has been dissolved, and there's a whole host of the list.
Right.
You would maybe know the litany better than me, but of these different ways that we had of monitoring.
One very important committee was within the military. There was a department devoted to studying crypto warfare coming from the Russian Federation. Hegseth closed that down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, a significant, you know, watermark, it seems to me.
Voter interference initiatives closed down.
Yeah.
Alba writes to us and says, my dear panel, Jay first. In a previous career as a German translator, I studied German culture and history. I hate sounding like an alarmist, but what is happening in the U.S. right now is almost exactly what happened in Germany with the rise of Hitler. I hope and pray I am completely wrong, but every step is following a path already traveled. And, I mean, Jay, this is obviously something that is we've talked about and for a long time, too.
I just want to very quickly add here a point, you know, that's a very astute comment. Because what we're seeing now is what was called during the Nazi era anticipatory obedience.
Right.
And that was a term that really, you know, emerged in response to Hitler's threats against Austria and the Anschluss that resulted. The union of the annexation of Austria to Germany.
Anticipatory
obedience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, we see this in all sorts of ways right now. I mean, I think very sadly, Muriel Bowser's raising of the Black Lives Matter memorial in D.C. Prior to the budget measure of cutting $1 billion from the municipal budget in Washington, but also what's happening at the level of the universities, which is something that is very close to me, given that I've taught for many years at different places, and I think that what Columbia has decided to do has been extremely foolhardy. Let me just say that,
full disclosure. Just about 30 seconds. So go
ahead. 30 seconds, I think that's...
But we have time when we come
right,
back.
Yeah. That's an example of anticipatory obedience, so it seems to me. Yeah.
And next up on the hit parade is Harvard, right? I mean, that's what it seems to be the next...
As of yesterday.
Yeah.
And we hope they react differently.
So we'll talk about some of that. We'll get to another letter or two, and then we'll move on to other topics in our time remaining with our fantastic panel. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll continue the conversation again. panel@wamc.org. We will go to BBC News and return right after this. Thank you. Well, we've all decided we haven't had enough fun yet, so we're going to go for about another 20 minutes or so. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome your letters. This came in from Alba, and I thought this was nice. My dear panel, I want to tell all my fellow roundtable listeners, quote, thank you for restoring my faith and my fellow citizens and for injecting me with new hope. For you writing such intelligent and insightful emails, I love you for it. Isn't that nice?
I agree. The good letters.
It's nice. I would point out there's a lot we don't read.
But they're great.
But, yes, it's a nice point.
But also, can I, in thinking about what Senator Booker is doing for the last 15 hours, which is reading people's letters, and a lot of times in the show people say, what can we do? What can we do? We want to do something. What can we do? I think what Senator Booker is reminding people is it does matter if you write. You need to write to your senators, write to your House members, and get your story out. Write to your county executives. I know there's a little back and forth with a group of women in Rensselaer County who wrote to their county executive asking about, well, what's the impact of these Medicaid cuts going to be on our county and our nursing home and such? And he called them, what did he call them, crazy ladies or something? He said something disparaging.
Steve McLaughlin?
Yeah. AMC had a story about it yesterday. But it really is important to, if you have a story, to share your story. Share your story with your local elected officials. What are these cuts going to mean? You know, ask mayors. Mm-hmm. What is it going to mean to you, mayor? What is it going to mean to the county executive? What's it going to mean at the state level? Because that's how we're going to raise people's awareness of the impact on their lives.
My wife has been writing at least one letter every day to somebody. Mm-hmm. And I was asking her about responses, and she said she's actually has gotten responses.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, sometimes they're form, but at least, you know, and here's what you can do more. It seems like they're getting better at answering.
Right.
And having something to say.
Because I think that's the thing that's missing is for a broader understanding of the impact, whether it's with NOAA, what happens if you don't have reliable weather information, or Medicaid, what happens to the Medicaid cuts, or the transportation funding, what happens when they freeze, or the EPA funding, what happens to local communities who had these clean energy projects in the works. They were bought materials or were about to buy materials, and all of a sudden the contracts get canceled. And to get that word out locally to the media, to your elected officials, to your community, raises people's understanding. So anyway, great letters. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go. I cut you off before we went to break, and not rudely cut you off, but no, I sort of cut
you
off.
It was fine.
Because we were running out of time, but you were just getting into the impact of this having on the universities, what we saw at Columbia, and as I mentioned, of now what we're seeing at Harvard, which is really interesting.
Yeah. So I think that there are aspects of this that have kind of flown under the wire of, you know, sort of the public perception of these things. For one thing, full disclosure, I'm an alumnus of Columbia. So, you know, I'm viewing this from a very specific, you know, a kind of, a, I guess, personal angle as well. One thing to sort of bear in mind about the capitulation of the university to the Trump administration's insistence that it had to meet a series of demands prior to having $400 million of funding for STEM fields restored. And STEM fields are essentially the sciences and the technical and mathematics, those departments, is that it had to put together a whole package about the effective way to battle anti-Semitism according to a very specific definition, which equates anti-Semitism with criticism of Israel, essentially. Now, this is a very tricky point, it seems to me, because Israel is a multi-party system, and you know one can disagree with the policies of the current government without necessarily questioning the right of Israel to exist. That definition has been completely tossed out the window. Now, any kind of criticism of Israel, whatever that means, let me put it that way, you know, this is a very nebulous idea, is now strictly speaking, verboten within the university. The other aspect of this is that what the university did was agree to the Trump administration's demand that it clean up its curriculum. Now, this has a very specific character. They want the Middle Eastern Studies Department to be put under receivership. But here's the kicker. That department is actually a part of a larger department, which is called Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies Department. So that whole department would be put under the scrutiny, essentially, of the Trump administration. Now, not directly, they would have, as a kind of a mediating figure, a provost who was appointed to oversee the evaluation of that department. But my point is that this is a met demand in the spirit of anticipatory obedience, which has far-reaching implications, right? Not just for Columbia, but for all sorts of universities. And I'll just end with this one comment about something that happened yesterday or 2 days ago. At NYU, Joanne Liu, who was the former international head of Doctors Without Borders, was scheduled on March 19th to give a lecture at NYU, and it was canceled. It was canceled at the request of the university because they were afraid that some of the slides that she would show about the civilian death toll in Gaza would be perceived as anti-Semitic. That was one aspect of the cancellation. But the other I found especially interesting and troubling, which was the university formally announced or said in their statement that some aspects of the talk would be perceived as anti-governmental. Now, this is new. This is, way beyond the remit of simply addressing problems of anti-Semitism. So I think that this is an assault on academic freedom, obviously, on free speech, and it is assault really on the whole idea of the university.
Which is supposed to be a place for free speech to prevail.
Well, that's it. If not, they're aware, right?
And as to the earlier writer's comment about that this is a troubling pattern, I was hearing, and you can probably speak more to this, an interview with a Yale professor who is leaving Yale to go to Toronto. He has written extensively on the rise of fascism. And one of the things he warns about is this appropriation of what is or isn't anti-Semitic, and how that the way it's being done by this administration is really dangerous to Jewish people, and that it's being used as a tool for a separate purpose, not a tool for which it's intended. And that he said he thinks what needed to happen, and this is what I thought, I'm not an expert in this either, but that Columbia needed to join with some of the other universities who are situationally powerful because they have strong endowments, like Harvard, like Yale, like others, and be a brace against this, because once they give in, then it's harder for the next one and the next one. And I did my master's at Harvard and got a note from the president, as I'm sure all folks did yesterday, about these impending, threats to cut Harvard funding. And in the letter, there's all about what they have done to fight anti-Semitism and how they're going to work with the federal government to ensure that they know that and do more things. But what I don't see in the letter is what they say that they will not do. Mm. And I think it's important that these universities say, we will not bow to this, that we will stand up to this. And collectively, as universities, we need to...
toxic to the Trump ear. You know what I mean? The people in the Trump administration.
But it's the slippery slope that this writer was talking about, that this is a pattern.
Oh, sure it is.
We're going... It's a very dangerous pattern.
They're walking a fine line.
At what point does it stop, right?
Oh, I know.
Because they're going
after
universities.
I know.
They're going after the legal community. They're going after the media.
I'm not agreeing with it. I'm just saying I understand their hesitancy.
But this is a template.
If they want to stand up, like, in Saratoga Springs this week, they stood up in the school district to support the policy of diversity, you know, inclusion
equity and
equity.
Inclusion.
Yeah, or equity and inclusion in the right order.
And I applaud them for that.
Yeah, and you know, but for a larger institution that's so dependent on federal money to do the same thing, it would just...
But the federal government is, they have to be reminded that the federal government is equally dependent on the research that they do. That's the flip side of it that we're not talking about.
I would certainly agree with you, but that makes sense and it's logical.
Okay, let me just cut in, Teresa, and say here, just, I don't know, I'm just wondering a little bit if essentially what the Trump administration doesn't care about research.
Yeah.
They don't care about, you know, about projects.
Finding a cure for cancer.
But no, I don't care to have my country go down a path fascism.
I agree.
So it's not the Trump people that you have to wake up. We have to wake up the Republicans in the House and the Senate. We have to wake up the governors. We have to wake up the mayors, the county legislators who are embracing this and not saying, hey, wait a minute. This is bankrupting our country. It's alienating our allies. It's making us more unsafe. It's bad for our economy. We need to talk against this. That's what Senator Booker's doing on the floor. This is not normal.
Yeah.
This is not normal. Where's the fire break? Is the fire break going to be the universities who stand up collectively, who have deep endowments and stand up to Elise Stefanik and everybody else and say?
I hate to say it this way. I think the Trump administration, as you said, Alex, doesn't really care about the benefits of research.
The House and Senate Republicans care?
Right.
In their own district. That's what matters.
No, that does. You're absolutely right. That's the fire break. You know, but I think that we have to view this, we have to almost bracket the whole matter of the assault on the universities and see it as a kind of a, how can I put it, a subroutine of a larger program of austerity cuts. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't see the point of, you know, programs like what the Center for Disease Control is doing, for example.
And today they're laying off thousands of people in the CDC, in the Centers for Disease Control, and the FDA. Yeah. But don't people care about the medicines that they get and whether or not
they
their
do.
Food, whether
so
or not
the,
it's safe?
So the Democrats have to do a more effective job about messaging.
Not just the Democrats. I mean,
the Republicans. We all have to.
Yeah, you know, the reality is this, that the Republicans who are in office in the House and in the Senate are quiet about all of this. They're not saying anything about this
publicly.
And the reason is this. They have rationalized that if they speak out against the administration, Elon Musk will throw $20 million at their primary the next time they run. Some right-wing crazy mega Trumper will get elected or get nominated, and or a Democrat will beat that person in the next election. So either way, my constituents will not have defending them, and that is more important than anything, so I better not say anything.
But that's a quaint belief that we will have primaries the next time, but at what point do you stop this? I'm serious.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that's, again, I'm yeah, going back yeah. to Senator Booker. Yeah. At what point is it, where's the tipping point? Mm. The writer who wrote in who said, you know, I'm a Germany
scholar.
I've seen this playbook before. What's the guy's name from Yale? Help me out.
Jason Stanley,
mm-hmm. who says, I have been studying authoritarianism and how this is the playbook. This is what's happening. I don't necessarily think it's Trump that's doing that. I think it's the vote and the Jason Millers and those people behind them that are moving this. But where's the tipping point? Mm. And unless we speak up now, like Cory Booker's doing, holding the floor, or you need House members, Senate members, other people, not quietly to say, hey, don't cut that funding, don't close that hospital, don't do this, don't do that.
If a few, just a few House
Four,
members and a few
five
Senate
Republicans
members
on either side
would have backbone, this would be a whole different situation.
And that's what we need right now. We need them to wake up and say, listen, this is a slippery slope. It's going down a bad path. Let's reverse the path.
This is Teresa without sleep. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap up the
program. This is why I can't sleep, because I'm so worried about this.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap up and thank all of our group for being here and get some last moments
from them. We'll be right back after this.
Are just a part of her story.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable as we finish up our panel segment on this morning's program for this first day of April. We have Teresa Bourgeois, Mike Spain, and Alexander Mihailovich with us, and we thank you for your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Diane writes and says, yesterday the president of Cornell wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying, Cornell will not bend the knee. What is it about Cornell that makes it difficult for other institutions to do this?
It's an interesting question. It's a much larger university. It's numerically, in terms of its student body, it's by far the largest of the Ivy League schools.
It's like 16,000.
Yeah, and they have a large school of agriculture and also a very famous veterinary school, but also many other moving parts. That might be part of it. They are, because of many of these schools, they're much more invested in their local community in a way that I would say, have to say, all the other Ivy League schools have been wretched failures at, town-gown relations. Harvard, Columbia, Yale, and University of Pennsylvania are pretty, have been pretty demoralized for many years. And so, yeah, I think it probably has a lot to do with, the particular place of Cornell within upstate New York,
But you don't think if collectively these folks organize themselves and engage their powerful alumni, there could be some sort of bulwark against this if they collectively did it?
I think I completely agree. I do think
that should
be possible. Yeah. So, but I'm not sure why they're not
but
doing
it. It would be a down curve before it goes back up. It wouldn't be instant,
Right.
And they're looking for relief. I mean, what's happening now is everyone is looking for relief until the midterm elections or looking for relief until Trump leaves office, and they're making all these rationalizations. But I think you're right, Teresa. I think the fear that you're expressing that if they don't act soon and act together, it will have a devastating effect. I agree with you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the case of the universities is very specific because they're worried less about, say, in the case of Columbia, the $400 million that are being withheld from them now. What they are really nervous about is what will happen in the future, because what typically happens in the STEM fields in particular is that you have these kind of rolling research projects and sources of funding. Sure, they could get that $400 million somehow patched together from the $14.8 billion Columbia's endowment has. But then what about the future? What if this sets a precedent and you can't have, any kind of reliable source of money or funding for very expensive STEM projects, research.
But they have the infrastructure. They have the hospitals. They have the labs. They have the, and again, if you work collectively, I mean, for Harvard, it's $9 billion. That's not a small number. But again, the government, the country needs their research as much as they need to be doing the research, and they have the infrastructure.
Totally agree with you. Everything you say, except the Trump administration doesn't care.
Right. So,
but again,
here
what you need to get to care are the House and Senate Republicans,
right,
because
totally agree.
That's
right.
The bulwark against the Trump administration.
Just a couple. All you need is a couple.
Five
with
on
guts.
Each. Five in the House. Five in the Senate.
What we're ultimately talking about in terms of the universities is not something specific to those institutions, particularly, but it's the idea of establishing a way of obtaining information that is independent of government sources and partisan interests. That is what research, both for the humanities and for STEM fields, accomplishes. And let me just give an example of actually having to do with Ukraine. The one nonpartisan, accurate survey about who in the Donbas region wanted to stay with Russia wanted to stay with Ukraine in 2014 and who wanted to be annexed to Russia, the majority of people said, we want to stay in Ukraine. 65% of those surveyed. And this was from an academic institution, independent researchers not affiliated with either the Russian government or the Ukrainian government. That's what universities and bodies of, you know, information gathering do. They establish a kind of an atmosphere for accurate, honest, nonpartisan information to be made accessible to the world at large. If the universities are under this kind of a new system, we won't have that to the same extent that we've had it for so many years.
And one of the things that makes the country great, this is going to sound trivial, but is our university-based research that is funded by the government that drives all sorts of innovation.
Right.
And we are the leader in the world in that university-based research, out of which many, many discoveries have come, or the basis for many other things. The digital camera, many medicines, you know, life-saving procedures, on and on and on.
Technology.
All sorts of technology. And and we cannot afford to let this group of people, Russ Vogt and Vance and those folks, tear apart this infrastructure. It has to be stopped, and the Republicans need to stop it.
The only thing we didn't get to today, well, there's a lot we didn't get to today, but what we didn't get to today that was on our list was that the brand new president of Colombia, Claire Shipman, has already been attacked by Elise Stefanik, who now is back in action as the congresswoman from the 21st Congressional District after her nomination was pulled by the Trump administration, and is coming under attack for a – Shipman is coming under attack by Stefanik for a email, a text message, actually, that was sent in 2023 that was critical of the investigation that – the House.
Three words, I think.
Committee.
Capitol,
yes.
Hill, or Capitol
nonsense.
Hill nonsense.
Yes, then that has started it all over.
How horribly offensive.
Stefanik
2.0. Say there was nonsense on Capitol Hill.
My thanks to all this morning. A great group and a terrific conversation. My thanks to you all. Mike Spain, Alexander Mihailovich, thank you so much. And Teresa, always a pleasure. We'll be back right after this.